some of the shared concepts, just even words that psychoanalysis and musicians use, are words such as conflict, ambiguity, silences, dissonance, resolutions, or not, working through, like in the Mozart you heard. What you heard in the very opening four measures was worked through this entire sonata. It was thematic, but if we played the whole sonata, and even in the first movement, you get a taste of it. Those themes are present throughout the sonata, just like in the patient's associations and interactions with you. And so we have music themes, we have core conflicts, and they get developed.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Julie Nagel. Julie Nagel is a psychoanalyst. She's a graduate of the Michigan Psychoanalytic Institute, and she's a musician. She's a graduate of the Juilliard School of Music. And with these two centers of rigorous training, Julie has lived a life of music and psychoanalysis that she shares with us. We begin by hearing a piece of music. As she and I talked, one can't discuss music without experiencing it. And she brought her accompanist with her. Her husband, who she met at Juilliard, Professor Louis Nagel, was good enough to perform some of the opening parts of Mozart's A minor piano sonata. And as you will hear us discuss, this is one of the very few examples of Mozart using a minor key, and he wrote this around the death of his mother in 1778. And we talk about the relation between the two, his life events, the affects he was struggling with, and how it's represented in the minor key of the music. And they bring out pieces of the beginning part of the sonata to demonstrate what they feel are affects of grief and upsetness and tension. And we go on from there and have a conversation about the overall interface between classical music and psychoanalysis. And she brings forward themes that we have in our mind, but really made more sense to me as we had a conversation. Patients come in with core conflicts, and there are themes that develop both within a session and also over the course of a long analysis. There are leitmotifs, there are common themes over the course of an analysis, and that's certainly true, of course, in musical compositions. And we spend time seeing the similarities in those ways of listening. She brings forward some clinical examples where music played a part in her work with patients. And we spend time on her personal story. The title of this is also From the Piano to the Couch. And she shares with us very poignantly how she received a piano when she was a very young girl and how that served her well in the struggles that she talks about in her personal life. And she has a phrase of being an ambassador, both for music and psychoanalysis, and she certainly fulfills that role. So I think you'll find this different. We haven't started with a piece of classical music before, and Professor Nagel is gracious in helping us out with this, and I hope you enjoy it as I did. Here's my conversation with Julie Nagel. Julie, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad to have you here. Julie, for many years, you have been a student of and a practicing musician. And likewise, for many years, you've been a student of and now a practicing psychoanalyst. And your life's work is not only devoting yourself to each of these fields of human experience and thought, but on their connection, on their interface. In fact, the title of your book is called Melodies of the Mind, Connections Between Psychoanalysis and Music. Now, music, as we well know, is a very broad area. We're going to be focusing today on classical music. I've had a conversation with Raphael Ornstein in the past, and we talked about jazz, improvisation, and psychoanalysis. I've had a conversation with Steven Goldberg and Lee Rather, and we've had a conversation about opera and psychoanalysis. Interestingly, we chose a Mozart opera as well, The Magic Flute, in that conversation. And today, one of the examples you do a deep dive in your book is Mozart's A minor piano sonata. And we're going to spend a little time on that. But as you and I both know, Julie, that you can't really just talk about music. One needs to listen to music to experience it. And it is our good fortune that you've brought your accompanist with you. That is your husband, Professor Louis Nagel. And he's going to be playing both a few bars of a standard Mozartian piano sonata, that is in G major. It's very unusual, as Julie will explain to us, that Mozart turned to the minor key. But he'll start us off with a G major sonata just to give us a flavor and remind us of what we typically think of Mozartian music. After that, he will then play some of the A minor piano sonata, and we will unpack it a bit to try to understand how it teaches us about it representing how his mind works. And let me read a paragraph that you've written about this from your book. You write, quote, "Musical evidence suggests that Mozart's affects of grief, disappointment, hostility, and guilt, and his experiences of object loss, his mother's death, his leaving home, his estrangement from his father, all interwoven with lack of professional success in Paris, are expressed musically. These intrapsychic and interpersonal issues are embedded in Mozart's uncharacteristic treatment of tonality, tempo markings, rhythm, dynamic emphases, use of counterpoint, and technical demands on the pianist." With that as an introduction, Louis, if you could start us off with not the minor sonata, but again, the more familiar G major sonata. And if anyone were to listen to that blindly, that is not knowing anything about it, and if you're familiar with classical music, it's a fair bet that even a serious amateur would be able to guess that that's a Mozart piece. Now, the piano sonata in question, the A minor, in contrast, share that with us, please. Now, that's quite a difference. It fills, my experience is that it's tension-filled. Julie, tell us what we just heard and how it reflects some of the psychological factors you feel were operative at the time.
Well, I think when you say tension-filled, Harvey, you hit the nail on the head, because Mozart had lost his mother during the period this sonata was composed, either before or after. But the way he begins it, first of all, with that grace note to the first note. A grace note is like an apostrophe. Louis, if you can play just the right hand. Da-dum, bum, ba-dum, bum. Mm-hmm. He doesn't begin his other sonatas like that. He begins them with the melody, something more beautiful, more fluent. There's something urgent, something pressing from the inside of his mind to begin this in the key of A minor, which he had never used before fully in a composition, and to start it with that grace note driving figure under which, if you can just play the left hand, unrelenting, I can't stop feeling this way. I can't say he felt that way. This is how I'm interpreting it.
It's an agitation, yeah?
It's an agitation. It's an urgency. It's an intensity. And you don't hear that in his other works. Plus this key. What in the world? I'd love to talk to Mozart and say, why did you choose A minor? You could have written this piece in a different key in minor, but why A minor? Which he used again, only again, the year his father died when he wrote the A minor Rondo. And so that opening sound you hear permeates the whole sonata, really. We're just talking about the first movement. He also gives, there's always a marking of how fast or how slow to play the piece by the composer, sometimes not. But this one, Mozart writes two words, allegro, which means fast. That was usually the tempo marking these classical composers would give a first movement. But he adds the word maestoso, maestoso meaning majestic, more thoughtful, not quite as fast. And then when I hear the word majestic, when I see the word and I think about it and I think about this music, it's his mother. There's something majestic. There's something different. And either she's not with him or he knows she's very ill. He knew that before she died. Mm-hmm. So he was dealing with death either before and or after, which was very painful for him. And he was also really unable to compose while he was in Paris. So this is the first thing when she was in this period of dying or death that he was able to come up with this sonata. So that maestoso, I think, has some reference to what's going on in his internal life of losing his mother. And you see that in these other themes. There's a theme in the development section, Louis, the contrapuntal theme. In it, you hear the restlessness of his mind in what in psychoanalysis we call displacement or overdetermination, a multiple function. But he's going to take that rhythm you heard in the beginning, put it inside into a middle theme, and over it, he's going to be playing the dum, bum, ba dum, bum, like in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And in the left hand, you'll hear Louis play da 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 da, the insistent, not chords like you just heard.
Right.
But you hear it broken up.
Okay, what
and
do we hear?
Here is how Mozart then he develops the opening material. Like in an analysis, material develops, it opens up as we talk mm-hmm. about it, and you hear mm-hmm. themes and variations on what the person comes in originally mm-hmm. saying. I'm so sad, my mother died, and I can't stop saying it. Now we're going to hear this open up, but it's agony. Can you hear all of that moving around? But you hear it. That's the bum, 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 but it's broken up and then play. And it doesn't get easy for the pianist in there. That's really difficult technically to play. Like three, if you had three voices, you were talking all together with three voices, but they were all saying something else. Mozart is trying to say how he's trying to process this through the counterpoint or the displacement of the opening theme, because that theme is also in da 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 dum da 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 da. You're going to put my voice on singing, but that's what he's doing. And then in the top voice, he's got the dum bum ba dum bum, and in the left hand, he's got da 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 da. Death is complicated. Dissonances, counterpoint, rhythmic complexities. His mind is full of something, and he's trying to get back to end this movement the way classical sonata movements end, in the key it opens. So he's working his way back, and he finally does at the very end of the first movement. We wind ourselves back up to A minor. Uh-huh.
Why don't you do that?
Let's play that.
Perfect. Thank you.
You know, every time I hear this played, or any piece, anytime I listen to a patient, you hear it differently you hear it repeated.
Yeah.
I heard it differently just doing it now, talking to you about it. Still that agitation is there in the left hand. But the right hand is doing what you're supposed to do, being a good boy, doing what daddy wants you to do, go out there and play and compose. And he's very, you know, rigid with bump, bump, bump. But the left hand is not happy.
Louis, let me thank you for being here with us. And let me close this piece by reading a quote, Julie, that you have in your book from Mozart that really puts into his language what we've been saying. You wrote, this is a letter to his father. He said, "Dearest Papa, I cannot write in verse, for I am no poet. I cannot arrange the parts of speech with such art as to produce effects of light and shade, for I am no painter. Even by signs and gestures, I cannot express my thoughts and feelings, for I am no dancer. But I can do so by means of sounds, for I am a musician."
Yeah.
Can I just add one thing? You talk about agitation. Consider the performer who's playing that. This is one of the hardest pieces Mozart ever wrote.
Thank you for letting us know that. I would not have known that.
It's really hard.
Okay. Julie, let's continue. And I wanted to read a few sentences from your book about the overall issue of the connection between music and psychoanalysis. You write, "The formal qualities of music and psychoanalytic principles mutually inform each other. This blending of musical and psychoanalytic knowledge provides an elegant schema for understanding the complexity of affects and their function as unique nonverbal pathways into unconscious processes integral to clinical work. Interdisciplinary exploration also serves as a model for examining the value and use of music and psychoanalytic knowledge, both within and beyond the consulting room and the concert hall." Well, there's a lot in that. Why don't you start us off and share with us how you see these two ways of thinking and experiencing oneself and others connect to each other?
Well, there's a lot packed into that question. But I'll speak for myself and how I've thought about it as a trained musician and as a trained psychoanalyst. But I want to emphasize, you don't have to have the training to have music speak to you, to impact your feelings, your memories, your moods. But let me just get a bit into, and I alluded to this somewhat when Louis was playing the A minor, that I came upon what interested me a lot was Freud's disdain of music. And Mozart, as Harvey quoted, "I am a musician. That's the way I can, you know, express myself." And Freud, he said he couldn't understand something that he was almost, I'm not remembering the quote. I'm sorry, I'm really, I don't want to even use that sentence there. But in Freud's concept, we were looking for oral, O-R-A-L, communication to try and understand the inner life of patients. With Mozart, who said, "I am a musician," he was so identified with music since a little boy, he could only express himself through music. And so I came upon the terms the oral road and the aural road, the oral for Freud, the aural for Mozart. Now I started thinking, what is the difference? How do we think about the difference in the sound, just having sound, which is one reason why I chose to illustrate opening today's podcast with music that didn't have words. That was a conscious decision because in Melodies of the Mind, every chapter except the Mozart chapter has words. And some music is composed deliberately with words around a story, around some kind of verbal opera, you know. But I wanted to get into the music itself. What is it about music? And I found very similar things between music and psychoanalysis, including things like the displacement of musical themes, making them different rhythmically, thematically, turning the melody upside down, making the melody longer, shorter, changing the key. But it was displaced from the original. And yet, like in classical music, which I'm emphasizing, because there's certainly a lot of musics that we could talk about, but my training's in classical, so I want to stick with what I know, that we're longing, like Harvey was saying in the Mozart, we're longing for this thing to end. We want a tonic, and that's what it's called when it goes back to a home key. We bring it to a solution. But music gets displaced, and so do, you know, mental contents, verbal expressions people use. You hear displacements of what they're talking about, but you can understand, and I'll get a little bit more into that when I give some examples, of how the core conflicts that people bring in and say, this is what brought me to treatment, become so, they just evolve into other things that have multiple functions, just like the counterpoint in the music that Louis was playing in the Mozart, that there is content between the manifest content of the melody and the manifest content of the words and the underlying meanings or the underlying counterpoint that you hear in the music. And also just as importantly, because to try and link the bridge between words and music is not an easy one, and I don't want it to feel artificial. It feels organic to me as a musician, as I was, you know, as I do this work and I think about it a lot. Some of the shared concepts, just even words that psychoanalysis and musicians use, are words such as conflict, ambiguity, silences, dissonance, resolutions, or not, working through, like in the Mozart you heard. What you heard in the very opening four measures was worked through this entire sonata. It was thematic, but if Louis played the whole sonata, and even in the first movement, you get a taste of it. Those themes are present throughout the sonata, just like in the patient's associations and interactions with you. And so we have music themes, we have core conflicts, and they get developed. I want to be sure, though, to say that I'm not make, you know, in music, we talk about interpretation. How do you interpret this music? If you heard 10 different people play this Mozart sonata or any other piece, you'd hear 10 different interpretations of the same notes, the same music instructions.
Sounds like a case conference.
Yeah. yeah, and there's a lot of disagreement, too, and discussion over which one is more authentic or something. And I like to think about with interpretation psychoanalytically, but certainly with music, to have a good enough inference, to have good enough evidence to support what I say. If I wish we had time just to do the whole sonata or some whole piece where you could really get into giving examples and involving people in understanding how music works, because there is something very musical to me about psychoanalysis, something very musical about listening to someone speak, although sometimes some of my patients will just break into song. There was something personally very therapeutic when I was listening to one of the movements, the mask movement from Leonard Bernstein's Age of Anxiety, of all things, right after my mother died. It consoled me. It didn't have words, but there was something about that music that went straight to my feelings and to my grieving, to my heart. There, but music is used for happy occasions, sad occasions, political propaganda, grocery store music to make you buy. We all walk around with these white earbuds that look like earrings now, you know. And I say that's close to putting music in your head as you can without it being, you know, embedded in your brain. But music enters and goes, in my understanding and my feelings about it, and my study about it, directly to the affects. It can bypass the defenses, which when we talk with people orally in our sessions, we are interested in the affects, but in the defenses that often prevent the affects. The defenses can keep these affects down. I find that music is like inhaling or drinking or breathing something that is very, it goes down. it just goes down. You know.
Tell us about your work with patients and how your mind being able to work in both spaces brings you more fully to the encounter.
Well, it doesn't happen when it happens. It doesn't happen in every session. Sure. It doesn't happen with every patient. And when it happens, it comes into my mind unconsciously from somewhere, which then I start to associate to what's going on. Why did this come to my mind now? Why
did this? Have an example you can give us?
I can give you a lot of examples, but let me. I had a patient was talking about. It was quiet. You know, there was one of those silences that you're wondering what's going on in their mind. And she said she got anxious when it was quiet between us in the consulting room. And as she associated, she said she feared I'd left the room when I wasn't speaking to her. And this is not music that came into my mind, but this was something that did come into my mind because her termination was coming up. And she had had a lot of issues around abandonment in childhood and people leaving her. And so even though it felt like she was ready to end the analysis, at least unless she wanted to come back at some other time, these silences were very uncomfortable. I asked her what would help her feel that I was not abandoning her. And she said music would relieve her anxiety. She could listen to music. And it made me think of music as a transitional object.
She knew of your involvement in music, I trust.
You know, I don't remember with this patient, but some of them do and some of them don't.
Uh-huh.
Or say they don't.
Right.
But she felt that music would relieve her anxiety. She certainly didn't know the story I told you about it, how it relieved feelings of grief. But another one, a patient came into a session and she was just raving about a concert she'd been to the previous evening. And she told me when she was sitting down, she wished I could have heard it too. And as we explored that, she was able to open up in a way that she had been more inhibited about in the transference with me, about wanting me to be with her, wanting me to share things with her, wanting me to hear things like she in things that she enjoyed, and to actually, you know, I couldn't go to the concert with her, but she wished I could, and you can wish anything you want, even though you can't always have what you want. But we had to talk, we did talk about this wish and what would that be like. But it was connected with me attending a music event with her.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And somewhat similar with another different patient. When he was walking to my office we were walking back from the waiting room, he was just humming. I couldn't detect a melody or anything, but just humming some tune to himself. And he didn't talk about it when he got on the couch. He just started in. And so a few minutes into the session, I stopped and I said, I wondered if he was aware that he had been humming a melody when he walked into the session. And he said he hadn't, but somehow him doing that, my noticing that, he was heard by me. I think he wanted me to hear him.
In ways he didn't even know he wanted you to hear him.
Right? He didn't know. And I was debating, you know, should I say something? Should I not? And I thought, yes, this was unusual. This was not, he was so stiff and proper and felt like, how can you get close to this person? I was feeling. And when I mentioned he was humming, the whole flavor of the session felt different when the music came in.
When patients learn about your musical involvement, does it produce familiar reactions or things that end up being meaningful? Because it's both music, but it's also part of your extra office life. We all have extra office lives, and patients, of course, have curiosity about reactions to.
Yeah.
Senses of exclusion in relation to what's it been like with you because you're so prominently involved with something outside?
I am prominently involved, and it's part of what I really believe too in psychoanalytic, my repertoire, because I do believe getting involved outside the consulting room.
Something and what are patients' reactions to that?
different, and mine are different to different patients.
Hmm.
Yeah. It depends on what we've been discussing, what's on the table, the kind of relationship we've had. Some people, you know, I feel more comfortable with that. I don't reveal about it, but I want to know what they feel and how they know. And I think more may know than I know, because I have things on the web and people look up, but not everybody tells. So I have one patient who very grudgingly admitted she did look up some stuff about me. And
that, as if it's forbidden, yeah?
It was forbidden, and it also provoked a lot of more overt, let's say, envious, jealous, like, you know, I have this wonderful life and everything has been easy for me, and I've had this other career. And so, but that's okay because it brought it out. I don't think that would come out. But it wasn't as comfortable as the one who was, you know, more in tune with knowing what I do. It really depends on the patient and on what's on the table at the time.
Speaking about your life, part of our title is From the Piano to the Couch, and you've had, in many ways, a dramatic life, and music has been part of it from early on, and you're comfortable sharing it with our listeners, so let me invite you to do so.
Well, I'm comfortable to a point, and
I understand.
Music has always been part of my life, but when I was 4 years old, I do remember being given a toy piano. It was white. It had 24 keys. It was given to me by my mother and my father, and I loved it, and I was able to sit down and actually play little tunes and melodies on it. And I loved that piano, and I played it a lot. And at that same age, when I was four, my father left. And I heard from him a couple of times when I was, my mother and I moved away. My mother eventually got divorced. We moved to live with my mother's parents. And that's where I grew up until I went to Juilliard. So my father came to see me there a couple of times and stopped. And to fast forward, to be perfectly, you know, to put another piece of this story together. When I was at Juilliard, I tried to find out about him. My family didn't talk. They kept secrets that I call secrets. I know my family just didn't like to involve me in what they thought would hurt me or upset me. And so I didn't know much about my father except what I read. Well, not what I read, but what somehow I was told. I didn't remember how I knew. I'll get to that. My father was famous because that's a part of part of what I want to talk about as we get into this story. Because I wanted to be a famous pianist when I grew up because this little piano really got me started. And I got attention and I got listened to when I played. And when I was 6 years old, I started piano lessons formally. My mother took me and found a teacher, and I stayed with her till I was 11. But something interesting happened when I was having lessons after I was 6. I used to compose music, and this teacher wanted to record a piece that I had written. And once upon a time, we had something called tape recorders, reel to reel, and she was recording it, and I was playing it, and I forgot the music. And I knew somehow that this was going to be recorded and it was going to be forever on these tapes. And I whispered very quietly to stop it. And she didn't. Stop the record. And she didn't. Either she didn't hear me or she just didn't listen to me. And I remember feeling so upset about these mistakes would be forever recorded, which I came to understand later, that this memory slip, which was my first memory slip that I can remember too, which is the fear of every performing pianist, was that I would be forgotten, not that I was forgetting the notes. And this is some of that displacement multiple function that you hear when you finally get into material with people. And as I was able to get into in my own analysis, that I would be forgotten, that I wouldn't be heard, that I wouldn't be respected, that I would basically be left if I wasn't with the fantasy of being a good enough girl. You know, and maybe that's why he left. But I also had, during those formative years, and my mother did have, she wasn't, nobody in my family was a musician, but she had the sense that I was losing interest when I was around 11. And it just so happened the pianist, and you may know the name, she's very famous, she's 98 years old now, and I'm in touch with her. She was performing in my hometown, Ruslan Chenska. And my mother somehow got hold of her and asked her if she'd hear me play, and she did. And she gave my mother advice. I mean, it's a little embarrassing to say, but I wouldn't say it if I didn't want to say it. So she told my mother, you wouldn't treat an orchid like you treat a daisy, and I think she needs a new piano teacher. And my mother found a very fine piano teacher who I worked with till I went to Juilliard. He had been to Juilliard himself. I think he put the bee in my bonnet about going there because I auditioned elsewhere. But when I was accepted at Juilliard, when I just didn't want to go anywhere else. And also my just great, effective musical involvement with Leonard Bernstein and the Young People's Concerts when I was growing up. He's my hero. I call him my musical father, and I never met him. Neither did I really get to know my father, although I met Leonard Bernstein's daughter, and she was a presenter at one of my discussion groups in The American years ago.
You mentioned your father's celebrity.
Yeah. My father was a celebrity that I learned about in the newspaper. You ask me, this is bringing up an association of my patients, you know, snooping online to see anything about me. Well, I've looked online. I found out, I knew that he had won 3 Olympic gold medals in speed skating. This was before he ever, I don't think he knew my mother then. They weren't married at that time. But he was very famous in his day. And, it's a mystery that has gone down with him when he died in 1981, even though I tried everything I could imagine to find out not what he did, but who he was and why. And everything led to a dead end, literally a dead end when he died. And when he died, he was written up in the New York Times, his obituary. I still have feelings. I mean, of course I have feelings about it.
Sure.
My piano teacher, Juilliard, knew the story and sent me the obituary. And I was not listed as a survivor. So this need that I've had to feel listened to feel heard, to feel understood, and my fascination with celebrity, including wanting to be one, because if you go to Juilliard and then you automatically have this big career, and I didn't know. I grew up in a small town in Virginia, but I wanted to go to New York, and I have this fascination with celebrity. I still do, but I understand it now, and I understand how the disillusionment that can come with putting somebody up on a pedestal is something to deal with. And I think that's important because musicians often, especially performers, and this is a whole nother thing that I write about in the career choices in music beyond the pandemic. What as I've been thinking about this, what really got me to write that book, which was just published, was when, as I called it, the bottom fell out of the market. There was nowhere musicians could play anymore, which is like a psychic death. You know, the illusion of being famous, or the illusion of at least making it. The career doesn't offer much money to those very, very fine musicians than it does to the superstars you may see, classical and otherwise. But then the pandemic, I mean, just the bottom fell out. And I related to that, and I wanted to write about career choice, which has interested me, including my own.
Yes. Tell us about how you made the switch to becoming an analyst.
I always say organically because it seems so natural. The analyzing music and being curious about what makes music work just seemed, as I started to get more and more connected with the analytic community here in Ann Arbor. And a part of it was, I guess, idealizing like celebrity in a way. I wanted to not only be one, but I wanted to understand, because when we moved, when Louis and I got married, shortly after he was hired at the University of Michigan and we moved here, we recently graduated from Juilliard, both of us. Well, he was still going on for his doctoral work, but we both finished our master's the same year, the year my mother died, we got married. It was a powerful year. And so I was always interested in stage fright, my own and other people's, and why nobody would talk about it. At Juilliard, then, now it's, they have some help offered. Then there was nothing. And everybody had it when you really got to know them, but nobody would talk about it. And I decided
more
I wanted
more secrets, huh?
More secrets. I don't like secrets. I like to find out if as best as possible, or deal with the fact that you can't find out everything you want to know, or you can't have everything you want, including a father and a mother who lives to be old enough to see her grandchildren or even her daughter.
So how does that get you behind the couch?
Behind the couch. These are hard. They're not hard questions. They're long answer questions, because they all are connected. Like I try and connect in the music and the analysis.
Mm-hmm.
What got me behind the couch? I went back to school when we moved to Michigan. Like Mozart, couldn't compose. I'm no Mozart. I stopped playing the piano after I graduated from Juilliard. My mother died that year, and I stopped. And then I was teaching music, and I started to feel like maybe I do need to play. And I was getting interested in maybe going back to graduate school at U of M. And I thought, I don't want to go back to school and just kind of try and figure out what I want to do the rest of my life, because I can't play the piano like I used to. And so Louis and I gave a lot of two piano concerts at the time. And I felt like I could do that. This was after the 7 years that I could do that, and I can move on to something else. And so I went back, I got admitted here, and I thought, you know, well, there are too many details, but that I started off in social work thinking that would be a good career and I could have a career. But I got so interested, I turned that into a joint career in social work and psychology, and I got my PhD in both. And by then I had gotten somehow enmeshed taking extension courses at the Michigan Psychoanalytic. I had friends who were psychoanalysts. I was starting to get invited to receptions and parties where there were analysts there. And I met my future analyst at one of those parties over a bowl of grapes, where we were both having grapes, and he introduced himself to me. And there was something about him that felt very sturdy and very solid, and somebody that, and I'd been in therapy before this, but this, I was toying with being an analyst. Hmm. And
sounds like you were ready.
I was ready. I was very ready. It, of course, involved leaving a therapist, which is not my strong point, and leaving and readjusting. But I was so ready. And if we have time for a quick story, this Mozart, to pull it back around to the very opening of the podcast, my second year, there was a course at the Michigan Institute on evidence, which I was really interested in taking. And as part of the class assignment, each one of us was supposed to present a case and give the evidence to support what we were thinking, feeling, saying, interpreting, and so forth, all the elements. And I didn't have a case yet. This really is important. So I looked around in music, and I found this Mozart A minor sonata. And again, like I told you earlier, I wanted to have something without words. You can't tell me I'm right. going by the words here. This is the music. Right. And I presented it. The protocol in the class was for everybody, whoever presented whatever case they did, we had to vote. Was their evidence compelling or not? Okay. So I did this music thing and the vote came and now you can say it's because my classmates, but I choose to think otherwise. Every one of them said that I had compelling evidence for it. And I took more time, it took more to spell it out.
Yeah, sure. Oh, that's lovely.
The only one who said the evidence wasn't good enough was the teacher.
Because you didn't have the patient's association?
I didn't have words. And I thought, but you don't need words. You don't need words and you don't need to be a musician. You feel it. You know it. I was sitting many years later. We're going to go on a long time with this, but I was sitting many years later. I'd been invited to do a lecture on Lucia de Lammermoor, the opera, down in New Orleans right after Katrina. When the opera house was reconstructed after all the devastation. And they were doing a whole weekend on the opera and they wanted me to come as an analyst to speak on it. And the singers would be in a panel and the conductor would be in a panel. And the opera was produced. So I was sitting in the opera that night next to strangers. And at intermission, there was a woman sitting next to me. I don't know who she was. I have no idea. But she just started talking to me about how the music had affected her, particularly at this point. And this is, a pretty heavy, gruesome opera, despite it being, Donizetti and beautiful melodies. Watch out for that underlying stuff that is. And she told me she'd lost her house, she'd lost her home, her children, adult children who lived there. Had to move away, and this was a family that had years of roots in New Orleans, and how sad she was. She didn't know I was a musician. She didn't know I was an analyst, but the music had spoken to her. And that was very moving to me to have that happen.
Julie, I have pulled up a segment that I thought I would read as we concluded today that you wrote about psychoanalytic and music ambassadors, who take not just the story you just told, but the spirit of the story you just told and share it with others, as we say, off the couch. But I don't have to read it because you just said it. You really gave an example of how the music speaks the soul and the soul can speak through music. And, psychoanalysis, the word psycho is often mistranslated as people think it refers to the psychology, but psyche in German translates to the soul. And both our field and your field, music as well, are both of the soul. And you really capture it so tenderly in your life story. And in your current life, you and Louis make music together and you share it with us. And I want to thank you. I've thanked him and I want to thank you for bringing your hard-won wisdom. I would call it that. I mean, I have some sense of what it takes to get into and to graduate from Juilliard. I have a better sense of what it takes to graduate from a high quality psychoanalytic institute like you did, and you've really devoted yourself to it. And you radiate it, and it comes through to me. I'm sure it will come through to our listeners, and I want to thank you for sharing it with me and the audience.
I'm very moved by your words. I'll say they should be set to music because they're very meaningful. Thank you.
They were just intended for you and the listeners. Thanks so much, Julie. It was a real pleasure getting to meet you.
Thank you, Bobby. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. We can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.